I felt inspired, if not compelled, to discuss this subject in light of current events, the situation in the Middle East as of November 2023. Not because this subject is topical, no. It is precisely because this subject isn't topical. In September of 2023, the unrecognized Armenian Republic of Artsakh surrendered to Azerbaijan. Consequently, over 100,000 Armenians were ethnically cleansed from Nagorno-Karabakh, a region where Armenians had dwelt for millennia. This major historical event received only token coverage in the Western media before quickly passing out of the news cycle, in scandalous contrast to the events currently unfolding in Gaza. This is typical of Western coverage of Armenia. Worse, it is indicative of how the fate of Christians in the Middle East has been reduced to that of a mere historical footnote. The current Pope may warn that Christians in the Middle East may disappear due to murderous indifference, a sentiment echoed by his Orthodox counterpart in Constantinople. Yet the political and journalistic indifference persists. I'm sure many of the people watching this video will have a conception of Christian history in the Middle East, but it is that of the Crusades in the Levant and the Outremer states. Fair enough. That is an inescapable facet of medieval history, inspiring adoration and condemnation in equal measure. It is a rich and nuanced subject, one that should never fall out of historical fashion, so to speak. But has it occurred to anyone why this topic simply drops off after the fall of Jerusalem to Salah al-Din and the Third Crusade? Is it that all the Christians simply left or died? If I were being conspiratorial, I might suggest that the enduring nature of the crusading narrative serves in part to perpetuate a victimhood narrative for Muslims and indeed Jews suffering under the yoke of Catholic Christendom, a victimhood narrative that loses currency with the fall of Jerusalem. I have covered the fate of the Byzantine Empire and Armenia elsewhere on this channel, where you can find various videos. If you want to find more about the Armenian Crusader overlap in Kilikia, there is a members-only video linked in the description. Armenia and the fate of the Anatolian Christians is a vital jumping-off point and companion in misery and doom with the rest of Oriental Christendom, but it is not today's focus. Here is a brief history of the Christians finding themselves foreigners in their own lands. Christians representing a panoply of denominations reflective of a diverse and ancient people predating the Muslim conquest, from the fall of Acre to modern day. The agony of Middle Eastern Christendom, a history of religious persecution. What is now the core of the Middle East, the Levant and Egypt, the classical Roman diocese of the Orient, represents the cradle of Christianity in the most literal sense. After the coming of Christ, the first conscious assembly of Christians gathered in Antioch, ancient Syria, but what is now part of Hatay in modern Turkey. Of the five great patriarchates, the major episcopal sees, bishoprics in Christendom, three were situated in the Levant and Egypt: Jerusalem, Antioch, and Alexandria. Antioch and Alexandria were the two great theological centers of early Christianity, and sources of competing interpretations revolving around the true nature of Christ. What complicates the history of Middle Eastern Christendom from here is the sheer scale and complexity of religious division or schism. In 431, during the Council of Ephesus, the Third Ecumenical Council, the followers of Nestorius were condemned, after which they maintained a presence in the Persian Empire, even expanding further east, becoming the Nestorian Church. During the Fourth Council, that of Chalcedon, a more dramatic breach occurred. Chalcedon affirmed that Christ was both divine and human, with two natures represented in a single person. This definition, Diophysitism, represented the position of the Antioch school of theology, and is the basis of Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant understanding today. Alexandria contrasted this definition with Miaphysitism, that Christ has one nature. Monophysites went a step further in arguing that Christ was fully divine, eschewing his human nature. The Miaphysites formed the basis of the Oriental Orthodox churches, the Copts in Egypt, Armenia, Ethiopia, and later Syria. Despite the early prominence of the Antioch school, after Chalcedon in the 6th century, the Syrian Church of Antioch underwent schism, a situation that persists even today. While the Christian Eastern Roman Empire still ruled over the Levant and Egypt, the religious division was never resolved. The Emperor Heraclius was desperately seeking a compromise, even as the Arabs conquered the Christian heartlands. The Christians, politically and religiously fractured, now found themselves under the rule of Muslims. The Christians were already divided by language into three religious rites: Latin, Greek, and Syriac. Syriac is a derivative of Aramaic, the language spoken by Christ, and the common vernacular language of ancient Syria and Mesopotamia. The decline of Syriac Christianity coincided with the decline of the Syriac language itself, as Arabic came to replace it as the lingua franca, the common tongue of Syria and Mesopotamia. The Christians were tolerated by their Muslim overlords on the condition that they paid the jizya, a religious tax, or perhaps tribute is a more apt expression in appreciating it as a method of subjugation. Nevertheless, under the Abbasid caliphs of Islam, the Eastern Syriac Nestorian Church of the East briefly flourished and even expanded. Headquartered in Baghdad, the Abbasid capital, in the centre of their Mesopotamian heartland, the Nestorians retained their original bishops in Persia and sent missionaries east to India, Mongolia, and even China, inspiring the legend of Prester John, lord over the hidden Christian kingdom of the Orient. By the 10th century, the church boasted some 60 dioceses. And yet, as the once mighty Abbasid Caliphate destabilized, the Christians suffered, retreating to the highlands of Assyria and modern-day Lebanon. In Assyria, the Christians were subject to constant raiding, first by the Kurds and then by the Turks, both of whom would come to settle in the region. In Egypt, the Patriarch of Alexandria had ensured a peaceful transition from Byzantine rule to Muslim rule. At first, the application of the jizya encouraged many Egyptians to convert to Islam, depriving Coptic Christians of secular leadership. Immigration from Arabia reduced the relative number of Copts further, and the suppression of Coptic rebellions all ensured Muslim hegemony. Though as a minority, the Copts were intermittently tolerated. The most dramatic exception to this was during the rule of the Egyptian Fatimid Caliph, Abu Ali al-Mansur, who purged Christians from prominent positions, banned Christian festivals, and desecrated the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. The attack on Christian holy places, the interruption of Christian pilgrimages to the Holy Land, and the stunning success of the Seljuk Turks against the Byzantine Christians all contributed to the calling of the First Crusade, its success resulting in the creation of Catholic outram estates, Edessa, Tripoli, Antioch, and Jerusalem. During the 12th century, the Crusaders occupied a commanding position in the Holy Land, until the rise of Salah al-Din and his conquest of Jerusalem, from which the Crusader states never truly recovered. Despite seven further crusades, Acre, the final Outremer bastion, fell in 1291. As the Ottoman Turks crossed the Dardanelles Straits into Europe, Christian polities were forced to the extremities, Trebizond and Cyprus, though the Cypriot kings would hold fast to their claim as kings of Jerusalem. How fared the Christian populations after the failure of the Crusades? Dating back ostensibly to the original transfer of power in Egypt from the Byzantines to the Arabs, the Christians were bound by the Covenant of Umar. The covenant provided the legal foundation for the treatment of the Dhimmis, the people of the book, with wider ramifications for Christians beyond Egypt to the whole patrimony of Islam. In essence, the building of new Christian places of worship was banned. Symbols of Christian devotion were banned or tolerated in modesty. Christians were disarmed and were expected to show deference to Muslims, from giving up their seats to ensuring that Christian houses were lower in elevation compared to their Muslim counterparts. Attempted Christian conversion of Muslims was strictly forbidden. Sumptuary laws ensured that Christians were made identifiable by their clothing. Then, as previously stated, there was the requirement of the jizya, the tribute. In return, Christians were permitted to retain their faith, albeit constricted, and the Muslim ruler was obligated to protect them, unless Christians attacked Muslims. Under these circumstances, one can appreciate why many ambitious Christians converted to Islam to avoid these restrictions, while the devout remained steadfast. Yet the covenant presupposed that the Muslim ruler would fulfill his obligations. Often this was not the case, and Christians had little recourse other than revolt. Christian religious leaders, like the Coptic Pope of Alexandria, for example, were either dependent on Muslim protection and favour, or effectively held hostage. Such was the motivation in forcing the Coptic Pope to relocate from Alexandria to the Muslim stronghold of Cairo. Moreover, the covenant assumed there will be a ruler capable of even providing protection. Written in the context of the first three caliphates, there was little anticipation of the rapid decline and dissolution of central authority throughout the Middle East in the 10th century. The Abbasids notoriously outsourced their protection to ghulams, slave soldiers, invariably imported from Turkic tribes in Central Asia. Contrary to what can be assumed from the appellation of the word slave, ghulams, mamluks, and janissaries at time had the power to control or remove rulers at will, or failing that, run amok. Delegation of military command, coupled with an over-reliance on foreign soldiers and irregulars, who often expected payment in land, invariably compromised a Muslim ruler's ability to protect his Christian subjects, especially if doing so would negate the loyalty of his own troops. The benefits and weaknesses of this covenantal system would reach their apogee and nadir under the Ottoman Empire. But beyond the implications of Islamic overlordship, Oriental Christians and Muslims alike were the victims of something worse. Political disillusion and anarchy in the Middle East accompanied the advance of the Seljuk Turks, which in turn precipitated the First Crusade. Two Muslim states in the Middle East rose to restore order: Saladin's Ayyubids in Syria and the Khwarezmian Empire in Iran. When the Mongols arrived, they destroyed the Khwarezmians and sacked the Abbasid city of Baghdad. For a brief moment, it appeared that Muslim power in the Middle East had been broken, and it was none other than the Nestorian Christians who, though diminished, had religious and dynastic ties to the conquerors that the Muslims did not. Hulagu, the first Ilkhan, or Mongol ruler in Persia, took a Christian wife. Together with the Buddhists, the Nestorians were favoured by the old Mongol elite. And through their support, the Nestorian patriarch envisioned an alliance with the papacy to defeat the new Mamluk Sultanate in Egypt and reclaim the Holy Land for Christendom. Nevertheless, it was here that the Mongol advance was finally checked, thus banishing those hopes. Acre, the last Christian holdout, fell to the Mamluks shortly after. In the wake of this failed invasion of the Holy Land, the Mongols were assimilated into Islam, the dominant religion of their subjects. The Ilkhan, Ghazan, reversed the policies of his predecessors and began actively persecuting the Nestorians. After the fall of the Ilkhans came Tamerlane, a nomadic warlord from Central Asia. Tamerlane was lionized by his Christian contemporaries for his great victory over the Ottomans at Ankara, which almost certainly delayed the Ottoman conquest of Constantinople by half a century. What was almost universally overlooked by the jubilant Catholic and Orthodox onlookers was that Tamerlane was responsible for the near annihilation of the Church of the East. Outside of an enclave in India, the church was reduced to a few towns in Assyria, though even in Assyria, Tamerlane was responsible for destroying the ancient city of Assur. A century later, the remnant church split, the Chaldean church entering into communion with the Catholic Church, and the Assyrian church claiming continuity with that of the old Church of the East. In the Mamluk Sultanate of Egypt, the Mamluks, who had indirectly contributed to the fall of the Nestorians in the Ilkhanate, policy was aimed at ensuring that the Crusades could never establish a foothold in the Holy Land ever again. To that end, the Mamluks targeted the Maronites. The Maronites, after their patron, Saint Moron, were a Syriac Christian community living in the mountains of Tarsus in Lebanon. When the First Crusade arrived, they contributed to the creation of the Crusader County of Tripoli, and thereafter entered into communion with the Catholic Church. They became the conduit between the Syriac and Latin-speaking Christian worlds. In the event that the Catholic Kingdom of Cyprus should invade the coast of the Levant, the Maronites would no doubt defect to the Christian cause. Accordingly, the Mamluks banished the Maronites from the coast. The Mamluks advanced into northern Syria, sacking the city of Antioch, while exploiting the divisions between Catholics, Syriacs, and Greek Orthodox Christians. They then went on to eliminate the Christian presence in Armenian Cilicia. Though perhaps the most marked change in the status of Christians was in Egypt itself, where a combination of punitive measures, church closures, forced conversions, reduced Christians to 10% of the population. It is difficult to view the hardline policies of the Mamluks as anything other than a complete repudiation of the threats to Muslim dominance once posed by the Crusades and the Mongols, at the expense of the remaining Christians. The demise of the Crusader states and the Byzantine Empire saw a massive influx of Christian slaves to the Middle East. The raids of the Turkish Seljuks in the 11th and 12th centuries captured tens of thousands of slaves from Mesopotamia, Assyria, and Anatolia. Following the fall of the major Crusader cities such as Edessa, the populations were typically enslaved en masse. Such was the case with the fall of Acre. Throughout the 14th century, Greek, Armenian, and Syrian Christians were enslaved by Mamluks, Turks, and Muslim pirates, where it evolved into a political custom for Middle Eastern rulers, a custom the Ottomans would inherit and refine. I ended part one of this mini-series on the history of Christians in the Middle East by talking about the twin disasters befalling that community. The campaigns of Tamerlane, which were tantamount to genocide, mainly targeted against the Nestorian Church, which had once been allies with his Mongol predecessors, and the complete repudiation of the legacy of the Crusades by the Mamluks, who, throughout the 13th and 14th centuries, were essentially able to eliminate the vestiges of Catholic rule and incarcerate the remainder of the Christians in Syria and Egypt. The continuation of this conquest against the last crusading outposts would endure throughout the history of the early Ottoman Empire, through the conquest of Cyprus, the island of Rhodes in the early 16th century, and even the island of Crete in the 1660s. The legacy of the Crusades in terms of demographic continued through the Latin Church of the East, and the descendants thereafter of the Genoese republics, the Venetian republics, and of course that of the Crusaders themselves. Mainly these people were of Italian and French ethnicities, and eventually they would intermarry with the Muslim populations there, and only to this day retain a very small percentage, to the point they are often derided as Levantine, and therefore not entirely European. If we can refer to the Christian history of the 14th and 15th century as catastrophic, and that is no overstatement, then this segment is going to represent the interlude between catastrophes, the period during which the Ottomans were ascendant in the Middle East, and during that time held effective sway, i.e. were in power, during their rise and before their dissolution. The Ottomans had started off by directing their conquests mainly against Europe. They crossed over the Dardanelles Straits in the 14th century and began conquering areas like modern-day Greece, Bulgaria and Serbia, expanding into Romania and even as far as Hungary and Vienna, albeit never taking that city. It was only during the reign of Selim the Grim that in a very short space of time in the early 16th century, the Ottomans expanded out of their heartlands in Asia Minor and conquered Iraq, Armenia, or at least the majority of it, the Levant, and indeed Egypt. Not since the Abbasid Caliphate in the 10th century had one Muslim power held sway over the entirety of the Middle East, in the Abbasid case, however, with the exception of Asia Minor, and in the Ottoman case, with the exception of Iran, which was held by their main adversaries in the Middle East, the Muslim Shia Safavid dynasty. The Ottomans, rather than innovating in terms of the management of Christians, merely inherited the structures of the Islamic empires that came before them. The provision for dhimmis was structured around the idea of the millet, the nation, but these millets were not nations built on ethnicities, but rather demarcations made on the basis of religion. And you can see that these millets were rather a system of allegiance groups to be shepherded under a particular ethnarch, invariably a religious head, who swore fealty, obedience, to the Ottoman Sultan or Padishah, Master King. So in this sense, you can say that the relationship was fundamentally that of feudal relations, that of reciprocal obligations, as stipulated in the Pact of Umar, which provided the legal definition of discrimination of Christians, their relationship with Muslims in return for protection. Having established this relationship with the Orthodox Patriarch in Constantinople, Gennadius Scholarius, this system, of course, related to the Greek Orthodox communities in the Levant and in Egypt. But the Ottomans extended this system to create an Armenian millet under the headship of the Armenian Patriarch. But ultimately, the Armenian millet is a bit of a misnomer, because it would come to represent all the Oriental Orthodox Christians within the Ottoman Empire, the Copts and the Syriac divisions. Why was it called the Armenian millet then? Well, if anything, the demarcation of an Armenian millet is to indicate the dominance and the influence of the Armenian community throughout the Ottoman Empire. This may come as a surprise given the history of the Armenian genocide and the Ottoman persecutions at the end of the 19th century. But the Armenians occupied a quarter in Constantinople, and as a mercantile class, were an elite with links throughout all of Europe, as with the Phanariotes or the Greek elites, and thereby were essential for the Ottomans in maintaining commercial and political dominance. Such was the case that the Iranians attempted to imitate the system when Armenians were brought back to Esfahan to establish their own Armenian quarter in the Safavid court. So Oriental Orthodoxy, therefore, was essentially subjugated to a hierarchy of Armenians. Then, in addition to that, you have the creation of a Catholic millet. As I explained in the previous episode, the position of Catholics in the Middle East was incredibly varied in terms of the Latin patriarchates, which were the legacies of the Crusades, the Maronites, who of course were focused on Lebanon, and the Syriac churches, who were allied with, or rather in communion with, the Pope in Rome. And that in addition to all of the foreign missionaries and Catholics of all ethnicities and all subsets and liturgical groups that dotted throughout the entire Ottoman Empire. And of course this would be expanded greatly when the Ottomans took over places like Rhodes, the Catholic Greek areas, and even places like Hungary. But what signified, you can say, the distinctiveness of the Catholic millet vis-a-vis the Armenian millet and the Orthodox millet, whose leadership essentially bore residence within the Ottoman Empire. Of course, the Pope, from which all these Catholic communities owed allegiance, was independent of the Ottomans. But more than that, the structure of the Catholic millet was based on the Franco-Ottoman alliance, an alliance formed in the 1530s against the mutual enemy of these two great powers, which of course was that of the Habsburg Empire of Spain and Austria. As per this alliance, and almost to offset the fact that France was seen to have made a pact with the devil in terms of the ongoing fight between Christendom and Islam, to sate fears among Christians back in Europe, and also to elevate the prestige of France within the Ottoman Empire, the French ambassador effectively acted as the go-between between Christians in the East and the West. He became their representative. He became their protector. So in the sense that the Pope became their spiritual protector, or rather remained their spiritual protector, the French ambassador remained their secular protector. And indeed, the longevity of the Ottoman-French alliance depended on Ottoman goodwill towards the Catholic populations within the empire. But this is not to say that the Christians were united under the Ottoman Empire. No, in fact, the Ottomans consolidated the divisions between Oriental Orthodoxy, Orthodoxy, Greek Orthodoxy, and that of the Catholic denominations. And what makes this more confusing is that the division continues and various groups switch sides during the next several centuries. So, for example, in the 1660s, one Patriarch Ignatius of the Syriac Orthodox Church precipitates a schism which saw many Syriac Christians enter into communion with Rome. Then we see the Melikite Greek Catholic Church in 1724, the lingering elements of that schism which pervaded the Church of Antioch in Syria after the Council of Chalcedon some 1300 years before. Together with the Catholic Maronites and the Latin Patriarchate, established during the Crusades, a position which was now ceremonial, there were, by the end of the 18th century, four Catholic Patriarchs of Antioch, an Oriental Orthodox Patriarch, and a Greek Orthodox Patriarch, testament to 1,500 years of schism and counter-schism. What fundamentally alters this picture with the endurance of the Ottoman Empire, an endurance which is abnormal in the long history of Islam, especially when you look to its great equivalent in the Middle East, which was that of the Sunni Abbasid Caliphate, because the Ottomans would exert control over this region almost without incident for 300 years, and often as a result of maintaining good relations with their Christian populations. But of course, the Ottoman Empire participated and continued the system of slavery. In terms of the innovations that the Ottoman Empire made to the Pact of Umar was that of the creation of the Devashirme, the slave levy, and the creation of the Janissary Corps, which by the 17th and 18th centuries had the ability to control and depose the essentially incarcerated sultans who were kept within the confines of the harem until they were allowed to be released at a certain age. All of this changed when you can say that the legacy of the Crusades rebounded in the Ottoman Empire after 300 years. And the most visible example of this is Napoleon's invasion of Egypt. Of course, when Napoleon came to Egypt, there was barely any crusading sentiment of the atheist in service of the French Republic in coming towards Egypt. Rather, it was directed against the maritime dominance of the British. But when Napoleon arrived, he tried to bring the Coptic Christians over to the support of the French, and he did so extolling the values of the French Revolution, that of religious liberation, that of elevating them from dhimmi, tolerated persons of the book, into becoming citizens, in which there would be fundamentally no demarcation between Muslims and Christian Copts, and Christians would have all the privileges of Muslims, most specifically that to bear arms, which was expressly prohibited under the Pact of Umar. But of course, this didn't go so far as Napoleon attempting to bring back a Christian Egypt as had existed in the 7th century. And indeed, Napoleon's innovations in this regard were undone almost immediately after, when he abandoned his Egyptian conquest and left command to one General Menon, who appealed to the loyalty of Muslims to France by announcing that he himself had converted to Islam, and then he subsequently began to purge all Coptic Christians serving in the then Egyptian government. Nevertheless, subsequent French relations with Middle Eastern Christians were to be far more amicable. The Muslim governments of Muhammad Ali Pasha, the Albanian who would come to dominate Egypt, and indeed he would provide the dynasty which would rule Egypt until 1950. French relations through the Ali Pasha dynasty ensured their enduring influence in Egypt and indeed in Syria when the Pashas expanded out in the 1830s and even threatened Constantinople itself. French support was critical in terms of gaining a foothold in Egypt and Syria. This continued until we see the creation of the Suez Canal, but ultimately the English, especially in Egypt, were able to supplant that of the French influence. And the precipitation for this again was the persecution of Christians, as per a Turkish uprising in 1880 within the Khedivate of Egypt, which evolved into an anti-Western and anti-Christian uprising. The murder of Christian missionaries and tax massacres in Alexandria gave Britain a moral impetus, which of course was already substantiated by a major strategic design, to take control of Egypt and thereby guarantee the jugular vein of the British Empire, connecting its Mediterranean Empire with that of India and its possessions in the rest of Africa and the Far East. Thereafter, Ottoman control, Muslim control in Egypt remained only nominal, and Christians were essentially guaranteed with an element of security under the new British-controlled Khedivate of Egypt. As for what was going on in the rest of the Ottoman Empire with regards to Catholics, during the Russian expansion at the expense of the Ottomans, after the secession of the Crimean Khanate to the protectorship of the Russians, per treaty stipulations, had been afforded the right of protectors of the Orthodox populations within the East. Earlier on in this presentation, I refer to the fact that the French ambassador in the 16th century had been afforded a similar stipulation as per the agreement of the Franco-Ottoman alliance. Napoleon III would use this as a way of countering Russian influence and precipitating the Crimean War. In other words, he was asserting his role as the supreme protector of Catholics within the Ottoman Empire. Given the fact that Napoleon III was instrumental in pushing the Russians out of the Ottoman Empire as per the Crimean War, and given the fact that the Ottomans were no longer in any position to resist the encroachments of Europeans, Napoleon III could affect this policy of protection like none other in terms of all of his Catholic predecessors. And indeed, this marks, you can say, a radical shift from the rampant atheism and indeed aspects of post-Christian deism encapsulated in figures like Robespierre, who wanted to destroy the Catholic Church in France, as opposed to Napoleon III coming back and treating the defence of Catholics in the world as his primary motivator for French foreign policy. That, and of course, it facilitated the growth of the French Empire. And the most obvious example of this was in response to the 1860 massacre of Christians in Damascus, a civil war that had broke out between the Maronite Christians and a group known as the Druze, who were their own ethno-religious group operating out of Lebanon and Syria, often in tandem with the Muslims, resulting in the deaths of some 10,000 Christians. The effect of this in terms of European sentiment and also that of power politics and the damage to prestige of Napoleon III as the protector of Catholics demanded an intervention by France. And of a European coalition put together, the French were the majority of that coalition and were directing it in allegiance with the Ottomans, who essentially wanted to restore control to that region. And the expedition was placed under the control of one Jimmu d'Otpol, who was also in the service of Ali Pasha in terms of expanding French influence by proxy into Syria some couple of decades before. You can say in a way that this represented a return of the Crusades, albeit with the European powers operating in tandem with the Ottomans, or rather forcing the Ottomans to do what they want. And this is encapsulated in the literature at that time. Within Britain, we have Walter Scott's Talisman, as per his Tales of the Crusaders. With Disraeli, we have his Orientalism, we have Tancred. With the French invasion of Egypt under Napoleon, we see the advent of scholarly Egyptology, Orientalism, and not only historical investigations into the medieval period, but you can say a Crusader kitsch embodied in the Second French Empire, but also represent an aspect of explicit French foreign policy, that of the defence of Catholics. After Napoleon XIII's intervention, the Christians within Lebanon were established with their own autonomy as part of the Mount Lebanon Mustarifate, which was first operated under an Ottoman, albeit a Christian Armenian, governor. By the second half of the 19th century, the city of Beirut, which is now the capital of Lebanon, was developing closer commercial and political ties with Europe, particularly that of France, which should come as no surprise. European interests lay in Lebanese silk and other export products, and this transformed the city into a major port and commercial centre. This increase in trade allowed certain elements, such as the Sursok family, a dynasty of Greek Orthodox Christians, to establish trade and manufacturing empires that further strengthened Beirut's economic position. Meanwhile, Ottoman power in the region, vis-à-vis its European handlers, continued to decline. Due to the civil war in Syria and Lebanon, Beirut became a destination for Maronite Christian refugees, wherein Beirut emerged as a predominantly Christian centre. In terms of demographics, by 1911, of the 120,000 size population of Beirut, 80,000 of those were Christians. The fruits of the European intervention were the security provided to the region's Christians and foreign investment. The French constructed a modern harbour and railway lines to Aleppo and Damascus, from which Beirut was the principal entrepot for maritime trade from the Levant to Marseille. The preeminence of Beirut resulted in a major restructuring of the Ottoman administration of the Levant, where Beirut was recognised as the preeminent economic and political centre as the capital of the Beirut Violette, or the administrative province. This is also indicative of major reforms taking place within the Ottoman Empire. The formal pacts or alliances with various religious heads, such as the leader of the Armenian Oriental Orthodox community, the Greek Orthodox community, and the Catholic community, had essentially been undone. This had to be replaced by a formal system of religious management, i.e. a codification, creating a constitution for the millet system, which was a pivotal aspect of Tanzimat, or the process of reform of the Ottoman Empire during the 19th century. This at once had the effect of recognising the plurality of Christian communities in the Ottoman Empire, yet it also signified the end of Greek and Armenian dominance within those particular religious sects. While this represented a careful balancing act within the context of Ottomanism, which was in many ways a postmodern ideology which understood that the growth of the Ottoman Empire had resulted in this alliance between various groups, the fact that the Ottomans themselves didn't consider themselves merely Turkish, they considered themselves to be universal rulers and the heads of Islam as their caliphs. In that sense, you could bring many different ethnicities and religious groups under the control of the Ottoman Sultanate. Albeit combined to this Ottomanism, you also have the introduction of the French revolutionary elements of popular government, Rousseau and the general will. So Ottomanism in many senses represented a harkening back to the legacy of Ottoman multiculturalism, for lack of a better word, yet it also represented elements which were antithetical to Ottoman autocracy, such as that of European parliamentarianism and democracy, hence the conundrum that is Tanzimat. Indeed, trying to link this idea of ethnic loyalty to the central government in Istanbul, combined with the growing consciousness of ethnicities, more than simple religious differentiations or group, which have been obvious for centuries, compounds various already existing tensions. The Ottoman dynasty, realizing the failure of Tanzimat, at first attempted to assert the preeminence of Islam under Sultan Abdul Hamid. And then the sultans would become captive to the forces of Turkish nationalism, with dire consequences for the Christians in the Middle East. The fundamental aspect culminating this period of the interlude between catastrophes and leading us into part three is the idea of an ethnic betrayal, a wholesale revolt of a people and of a community against a multicultural Ottoman Empire. If you recall back to my videos on the Greek Civil War, my belief is that the Greeks during the Ottoman Empire were the lingering elements of the Romaioi, Romans, Greek Romans, and that the Phanariotes represented a Greek Orthodox aristocracy upon which the Ottomans depended not only for administration, especially that of the administration of the Wallachian principalities as the hospodars, but also for diplomacy and for trade, especially in the 18th century as the Ottoman Empire ceased to be an empire of expansion and instead became territorially stagnant and indeed began to decline. When the Greek Civil War comes around, the Ottomans begin to eliminate the leadership of the Miletorum, the nation of Rome, the Greek Orthodox community, as everyone was in some sense responsible for this betrayal by the Greek populations in the Peloponnese and when Ypsilantis crossed the Pruth. So this idea of ethnic tensions and religious tensions, the thin line between religious loyalty to the Ottomans and this idea of independence beginning with the Greek Revolution, is the foundation of all the horrors that are going to be brought on the Christian populations within the Ottoman Empire. And it is already apparent that before we get to the 20th century, and before we come to the specific examples of the Maronites and the Assyrians, which are going to be that focus, this had already happened to the Armenians. The Armenians who, as with the Phanariotes, represented a pivotal position within the structure, the commercial and political religious structure of the Ottoman Empire, began to be associated as a foreign subversive force, particularly emanating from the Russians, and would be the target of extreme persecutions, resulting in the deaths of thousands towards the end of the 19th century. But in terms of this period, this prelude between another before another catastrophe, and the interlude between the Tamerlane persecutions and the Mamluk persecutions and the Kafno, the starvation, and the Sappho, the Assyrian genocide, I'm going to leave it here. As Europe hurtled towards the apocalyptic confrontation that was the Great War, the situation for Christians under Ottoman rule continued to deteriorate. The Christians of the Middle East, from Palestine to Syria, Mesopotamia and Assyria, remained divided by denomination, a fact that was integral to the Ottoman system of administration for the dhimmis, the millet, or nation. In this way, the Ottomans could prosecute a policy of divide and rule, while foreign sympathy towards Christians was inconsistent, contingent on whether those Christians were Orthodox, Catholic, Oriental, or Nestorian. We have seen already that Catholic Christians in the Levant were faring better, owing to the protection of France and the economic investment pouring in from the West. Eastern Orthodoxy, once a core constituency for Ottoman rule, the Millet of Rum, the source of the Greek-Ottoman elite, the Phanariotes, and an endless supply of slaves, was transforming into an existential threat to the Ottomans. Throughout the 19th century, Orthodox Christians throughout the empire, from the Greeks in Hellas and Pontus, the Serbs, Bulgarians, etc., had revolted and gained independence in former Ottoman provinces, invariably with the support of Russia. The Ottoman response was typically heavy-handed and bloody, which ironically elicited considerable sympathy from the West to the plight of Christians, precipitating Western intervention on their behalf. Such was the case in 1827 and 1877. In the latter war with Russia, Armenian-majority provinces were sundered from the Ottoman Empire in their Anatolian heartlands. Were it not for the pro-Ottoman intervention of the British, the Ottomans may have lost both Europe and Armenia in the 1870s and 80s. Thus, when the Ottoman Sultan Abdulhamid II committed his self-coup in 1878, it was off the back of a growing and appreciable sense of antipathy and paranoia directed towards both the West and the Ottomans' own Christian populations. The Christians, who were perceived as increasingly alien, client groups of foreign powers, a fear compounded by the presence and activity of Western Christian missionaries. Abdulhamid II turned the Ottomans inwards towards Turkish nationalism and pan-Islamicism. But the tale of the Greeks and the Armenians is not the subject of this video. Their story has been covered extensively elsewhere on this channel. Indeed, what is noteworthy about both the Greeks and the Armenians is that they at one time had occupied pride of place in the upper echelons of the Ottoman hierarchy. Ethnic Greeks were the first among the Eastern Orthodox populations, as the Armenians were the first among the Oriental Orthodox. From the Ottoman perspective, their response to these constituencies was that of a perceived ethnic betrayal. For the Christians, it was a dramatic and tragic fall from grace. I openly wonder whether the Greeks and the Armenians would have fared better as privileged vassals under the Ottomans rather than national enemies, a situation which persists to this day. Whether or not such speculation is warranted, the tragedy of the Christian Aramaeans, by contrast, is that their persecution was a consistent feature throughout the history of Islamic dominance. Even now they remain stateless. My aim here is to tell their history and their path to martyrdom, the Sipho, to be put to the sword in the Neo-Aramaic language. The subtitle I've used here, The Assyrian Genocide, I've opted for the sake of audience recognition, though I'm loathed to use it. Why? The term Assyrian genocide is a modern, post hoc, and somewhat misleading descriptor. Assyrian nationalism is a relatively recent and contested phenomenon. Assyria conjures up the distant impressions of the Assyrian Empire of the ancient world, one of the world's first empires. The aspirations of modern Assyrian nationhood represents a total inversion of the dominion that the Assyrian Empire once held over the Middle East. Nevertheless, there are aspects of continuity between the two. They occupy the same core of ancient Assyria in the heart of modern Kurdistan, which is itself split between Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. They speak a derivative of ancient Aramaic, the lingua franca of the Middle East, of antiquity, corresponding to the borders of the Neo-Assyrian Empire of the 7th century BC. Aramaic there was influenced by the Assyrian-Akkadian language. What really distinguishes modern Assyrians from their neighbours is their steadfast devotion to Christianity. As an Aramaic-speaking people with a Syriac liturgy, they can trace an identity back to the early days of Christianity. The diaspora thus identifies as Arameans and Syrians as well as Assyrians. The points of demarcation are their Christian denominations. Christians who follow the West Syriac Christian liturgy, both Catholic and Oriental Orthodox, are more likely to identify as Syriac. Chaldean is a broad description which has been typically applied to many Assyrian Catholics. The Nestorians of the Old Church of the East are most intimately associated with modern Assyrian nationalism, as is reflected in the 1976 rebranding of the Church of the East as the Assyrian Church of the East. Religious division, in my view, at once conflicts with modern Assyrianism, and yet it typifies it. For two millennia, Aramaic speakers had been divided by denomination, to the point that division had become their defining historical feature, not a bug. Far more so than the Catholic-Protestant division in Germany. Yet there is a far earthlier reason behind the advocacy of Assyrianism. To be Assyrian is to claim Assyria as a homeland, to define the borders of a nation, and to claim that nation as a supreme reality that has existed for millennia. It is a claim to legitimacy vis-à-vis their neighbours, and it is a compelling claim, especially when one considers the preposterous Anatolian nationalism of Kemalism in Turkey, which attempts to establish an unbroken link between the Turks and the Hittites to justify the Turks as a first people, and the Armenians, Aramaeans, and Assyrians as subsequent interlopers. Genocide is a secular concept, the erasure of a people, in this case the Assyrian people. With everything that has been said, I am not content to view these events through the secular lens of genocide, for to me, martyrdom, to die for one's faith, is as, if not a more apt descriptor. With all the complexity and implications of these terms, I find there to be something elegant and yet horrifying in the simplicity of the Neo-Aramaic appellation of the Sipho to be put to the sword. I ended the discussion of the Assyrians in part 1 with the Schism of 1552. What is so significant about this event that divided the Church of the East between those in communion with Rome and those who were not? As I've already mentioned, the Ottomans structured their administration of conquered peoples around religious denominations through the allegiance afforded by Christian patriarchs. The implication of this went beyond religion, wherein a patriarch represented both a denomination and a nation within the Ottoman Empire. To be a patriarch and an ethnarch, head of an ethnos or people. The Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, for example, was the head of the Roman nation, or Rum, within the empire. In the absence of a king, let alone an independent kingdom, the only realistic option for Assyria was autonomy under a religious ethnarch subject to the Ottomans, or perhaps the Safavid Shia Persians. The Assyrian patriarchs of Alkosh came closest to this. For 100 years, the Elia dynasty established a system of hereditary succession to the patriarchate, mimicking the practice of royalty. The missionary efforts of Franciscan Catholics and the religious and political frustration directed towards the Elia line culminated in the defection of the Mosul-based priest, John Sulocca, who received the title of Catholic Patriarch of Babylon from Pope Julius III. Consequently, the Church of the East never consolidated sufficiently to establish an Assyrian nation within the Ottoman Empire. For centuries, the ever-diminishing refuge of the Assyrian people was confined to a region effectively stateless. Tamerlane had driven the majority of Nestorian Christians from Baghdad and the ancient Assyrian heartlands around Mosul into the mountainous Hakkari province of modern-day Turkey. Divided by denomination, the Assyrians were further divided into tribes, the Jilu, Dez, Baz, Tukuma, Tal, and Tiari, each in control of a cluster of villages. The Orthodox Assyrians clustered further west in the modern provinces of Diyarbakir and Mardin. Seldom did the Assyrians form the majority in any larger settlements. A tenuous balance existed between the Assyrians and the more recent Kurdish arrivals. Low-intensity conflict simmered on for centuries, characterized by localized attacks on trade caravans, cattle rustling, kidnapping, rape, pillage, and looting. Looting, including that of Assyrian monasteries, which were invariably political as well as religious centers, fortresses, and libraries home to Syriac manuscripts and other antiquities. However, tribal divisions precipitated intra-ethnic conflicts, wherein Assyrians allied with Kurds and fought other Assyrians. To make matters worse, following the Battle of Chaldiran, Assyria became the border region between the Ottoman and Persian empires. Under the kings Shah Abbas and Nader Shah, the Persians led major expeditions into Ottoman territory, intensifying regional conflict and anarchy. Anarchy, however, did have its uses. The smaller Assyrian enclaves were self-governing, avoided Ottoman taxes, the jizya, and the worst aspects of the devashirme, the enslavement of Christian boys. Where the covenant of Umar did exist between Muslims and Christians, protection, applying that word very liberally, was afforded by the local Kurdish emirs. In the 1830s, Ottoman rule in the Middle East seemed on the brink of collapse, as the Albanian Pasha of Egypt, Muhammad Ali, conquered Syria and even threatened Constantinople itself. Local Kurdish emirs and foreign powers smelled blood. The British in particular were concerned by the Franco-Egyptian alliance and took active steps to counter would-be areas of French influence in Mesopotamia and the Levant. The British sent a delegation, under a native Assyrian, Hormuzd Rassam, to woo the Assyrian tribes into accepting the protection of the British. This coincided with a flurry of British-American missionary activity. However, contrary to elevating the prestige of the Assyrians, their hospitality to the British had made them a target for Kurdish reprisals. In what began as a succession struggle, the Kurdish emirs Badr Khan and Nurullah formed an alliance with Ibrahim Pasha, son of Muhammad Ali, to cement their rule over the Ottomans' eastern provinces. The Nestorian patriarch Shimun XVII made the mistake of allying the Assyrians with a rival Kurdish emir, which made the Assyrians the singular object of Badr Khan's wrath. From 1843-6, 10,000 Assyrians were killed, many more were enslaved, and even the patriarch's mother was murdered and quartered. Though the Assyrians were weaker than ever, the Kurds' victory was fleeting. The Ali Pashas were driven out of Syria, and the Ottomans put an end to the rule of the Kurdish emirs. This pattern of atrocities, foreign intrigue, and the ensuing paranoia of the Ottoman government in Constantinople would only intensify. In 1877, the Ottomans and Russia went to war. In the 1860s, the Russians had committed genocide against the Circassians in the Northern Caucasus, an extreme response to British overtures during the Crimean War to the Circassians, and something eerily similar to the situation in Assyria 30 years before. The remnant of the Circassian population sought the protection of the Turks. In 1878, the Russians annexed the Turkish region of Kars, exacerbating fears that the Russians were instigating Armenian nationalists to serve as fifth columnists in a future conflict. The Russo-Turkish enmity recontextualized the relationship between the ruling and the ruled populations of these respective empires. the marginalized Assyrians and Armenians, potential allies of Russia, and the Azeris, potential allies of the Turks. With the self-coup of Ottoman Sultan Abdulhamid II, the empire reversed a general trend to constitutional reform, Tanzimat, along western lines, and bolstered the Sultan's role as autocrat and caliph, the natural protector of Muslims in the empire and beyond. Within this bolstered Islamic conception of rulership, suspected treason served as a pretext to abandon the protections of the Covenant of Umar and seek vengeance on the Christians in the name of rectitude. During the 1880s, Kurdish raids against Assyrians and Armenians continued. This was, of course, a feature of life in the Ottoman East. But now Arabs and Circassians joined the Kurds, and by the 1890s, the raids were increasing in their ferocity. Indeed, rather than punish the Kurds, as had been the case in the 1840s, Hamid sanctioned the raids, casting the Kurds as his Hamidian regiments. By 1894, the raids had intensified into a series of deliberately perpetrated massacres, the Hamidian massacres. Though the Armenians bore the brunt of the onslaught, the attacks were fundamentally anti-Christian in character. Indeed, the massacres can be seen as the final dissolution of the Armenian millet, of which many Assyrians were a part. The vulnerability of the Assyrians was thus a direct consequence of the Armenians' dramatic fall, a shattering of the shield that had once protected them in theory. In addition to over 100,000 Armenian dead, 25,000 Assyrians were killed, and the knock-on effect was an empire-wide Christian exodus. Though the Christians in Syria and Lebanon fared better than their eastern counterparts, hundreds of thousands of them decided to emigrate for Europe and America. The last hope for the Assyrians came with the deposition of Abdulhamid II, and the possibility of reform that would favour the Christians. Nevertheless, Kurdish attacks continued on regardless, and after 1913, the coup of the three pashas, and of Enver Pasha in particular, the Ottomans adopted an aggressive pan-Turkic policy. The sudden loss of most of the Ottoman territory in Europe led to a policy of resettlement, the resettlement of Turks and Muslims from the Balkans to the Ottoman border with Russia, while the local populations were displaced. Thus, the policy of Turkification at the expense of the Assyrians and the Armenians began prior to World War I. When the Ottomans ordered general mobilisation in 1914, the Assyrians were placed in an impossible situation. The Nestorian patriarch Shimon XIX implored the Assyrians to fulfil their duty as Ottoman subjects. Orthodox Assyrians near Diyarbakir and Mardin generally acquiesced to conscription, while the Nestorians in Hakkari resisted. The resistance to conscription in Hakkari is generally considered to be the beginning of the cipher. At first, Assyrians fled to Iran, which provoked a direct response by Talat Pasha, the Ottoman Interior Minister, and one of the three ruling pashas. An order was given to the governor of the Van Vilayet, the Vilayet encompassing Hakkari, to forcibly move the border Assyrians west in anticipation of an Assyrian insurrection. The insurrection never materialised, and the government lacked the efficiency to carry out the order. Instead, the situation devolved into random violence and killings by irregular forces. When the Russians advanced into the Van Vilayet and promptly retreated, the Christians of the occupied towns were treated by the Ottomans as Russian collaborators. Until now, the Turkification policies of the three pashas had been at odds with the non-Turkic, though Muslim, Kurds. Understanding that the Kurds were also being driven into the arms of the Russians, the pashas reversed this policy, appealing to the pan-Islamic legacy of the Hamidian regiments. Indeed, in November of 1914, the Ottoman Caliph formally proclaimed a jihad, a Muslim religious war. Kurdish enmity was thus redirected towards the Assyrians at the behest of the Turks once more. When Kurdish irregulars attempted to cut the bulk of the Assyrian tribes off from the patriarch's capital at Kutshanis, the tribes mobilised for war with the Turks. An Ottoman offer of Assyrian autonomy in return for service was rejected as insincere given the circumstances. Shamoun then entered into negotiations with the Russians. Beyond coordinating with the Russians in the defence of the Armenian population of Van, the Russians could offer no major support. As of May of 1915, the Assyrians were prepared to face off a planned encirclement by the Mosul governor Haider Bey. The Assyrians had the advantage of terrain and successfully faced off many Ottomans, incurring unsustainable losses. The Ottomans had the decisive advantage of guns, machine guns, artillery, and manpower, and progressively forced the Assyrians to retreat further into the mountains as their villages were laid waste. After the summer campaign of 1915, the Ottomans had destroyed the Assyrian sources of food. Continued large-scale resistance was impossible. Many abandoned Hakkari to enlist with the Russian army. During the campaign, the Ottomans had captured the brother of the patriarch Shamoun, Hormuz, in Constantinople, and used him to leverage the surrender of the Nestorians. In response, Shamoun declared, "It is impossible for me and my people to surrender after seeing the atrocities done to my Assyrian people by your government. Therefore, my brother is one. My people are many. I would rather lose my brother, but not my nation." The Ottomans dutifully executed Hormuz. Shamoun himself remained in exile in Iran until he and his entourage were murdered by Simko Shikak, a Kurdish nationalist. The massacre of Christian civilians coincided with this call to jihad. The violence spilled over into Iran, where around Lake Omiya lived some 30,000 Christians. The Turks had hoped to enlist the aid of more Sunni Kurdish irregulars through there in Shia Iran, though Shia Iran was officially neutral. The Christian refugees in Iran received Russian support and weapons, but without an immediate Russian military intervention, 20,000 Christians fled when the Turks invaded Iran, despite the attempts by one Christian, Aga Petros, to resist the invasion. When the Russian counterattack finally came, the Turks looted Christian villages during the retreat. Pillaging was justified as a military necessity for requisitions. Further west, the mobilization of the Assyrians under the Nestorian Patriarch and the fear of future defections to Russia precipitated reprisals against the Chaldean Catholics and the Orthodox Assyrians in the Christian Diocese of Sirte. Priests and the Catholic bishop there, Adai Sher, were arrested and later killed. This pattern of rounding up and killing the Christian clergy was repeated on a larger scale at Diyarbakir. There, the governor, Mehmet Reshid, broadened a government policy directed towards the Armenians to encompass an attack on all Christians of every race and denomination. Syriac Christians saw hundreds of their villages razed to the ground between Diyarbakir and Mardin. The most brutal instances of the massacres were of Tel Emran and Eskor. Those who weren't killed were deported or arrested and forced into labour battalions. Many Christians, however, resisted, coalescing into the Midyat rebellion in the hilly region of the Tur Abdin in the Mardin province. Here the Assyrians successfully repelled the Turks and Kurds at Iwado under the forces of Galo Shabo and at Azak under Inagabri. The prospect of the Armenian genocide expanding into a generalized Sifo directed at all Christians had disturbing implications for Turkey's allies in the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary and Bulgaria. The unexpected Assyrian victory at Azak caused the Germans to lobby for a general ceasefire. On Christmas Day 1915, the policy of deportation was rescinded and the Christians were permitted to stay. Tur Abdin became a rare instance of triumph in the overall context of the Sifo. Despite the Christmas truce, the damage had already been done. The Assyrian heartlands in Hakkari were destroyed. Overall, some 250,000 Assyrians, whether Chaldean, Orthodox or Nestorian, had been killed, roughly half of their population. The Assyrian Sifo, occurred concurrently with the Armenian genocide, wherein at least 1 million were killed, and the genocide directed against the Greeks and Greek Orthodox, with casualty figures ranging as high as 750,000. Perhaps the Germans, all too willing to goad the Ottomans into jihad in the wild hopes of precipitating a general Muslim insurrection in the British Empire, had only considered the effect on Middle Eastern Christendom after it was already too late. I cannot leave this conversation without mention of the Kafno, the great starvation of the Maronites in Lebanon. It is difficult to situate the Kafno within the same narrative as the Armenian Genocide and the Sipho, though the results were the same, the mass deaths of Christians. In Lebanon, the Kafno led to the death of 200,000 people of a population of 400,000, more so than the German alliance with the Ottoman jihadis and the clumsy British overtures that helped cause the Assyrian massacres in the 1840s, the disaster here can be largely attributed to the Entente naval blockade in the Mediterranean. The French had invested heavily in Lebanon and Syria, and in Beirut in particular. The local economy in the Beirut Vilayet was geared towards international exports, while the legacy of the French military intervention in the 1860s had afforded the Maronites a high degree of autonomy relative to the other minorities of the Ottoman Empire. Both the economy and autonomy of Lebanon were dependent on the grace of foreign European powers, European powers that were now hostile to the Ottomans. With no food coming in from Europe, and the failure of various American-led humanitarian efforts, the Maronites were now totally dependent on the local Ottoman economy for food. Rather than feed a remote mountainous region inhabited by Christians suspected of potential treason, the Ottomans had a simple yet horrific solution: stop the food supply. Under wartime conditions, the commandeering of civilian trains and the requisitioning of food for the army now facing off against the British at Suez, was deemed a priority over the needs of the civilian population. But beyond this, military commanders on the ground consistently forbade the import of foodstuffs in the Lebanon. In other words, the Ottomans exploited the Entente blockade to subdue the Christian population through starvation, whereas the Assyrians were subdued by the sword. Kafno and Sipho, different strategies with the same effect. At the Paris peace conferences, Assyrians and Chaldeans attended, but were unable to present themselves as a large official delegation. An ambitious proposal was submitted to establish an Assyrian-Chaldean nation-state, whose projected territories were eerily similar to the territory claimed by the Kurdish nationalists. The principal argument presented was that the Assyrian Christians could not live under a Muslim government, either Kurdish or Turkish. The Sykes-Picot Agreement had already assigned Ottoman Syria and Iraq as mandates of France and Britain, respectively. The Treaty of Sèvres awarded Armenia a significant expanded territory with access to the sea. Of the remaining Ottoman territory east of the Euphrates River, an autonomous Kurdistan was created. The Assyrians were uniquely snubbed, even by the terms of the more lenient Sèvres, as they were placed within a Kurdish autonomous zone with clauses in the treaty to guarantee their protection. Lebanon, by contrast, was placed under direct French protection as a mandate. Even Greece was awarded an Anatolian enclave around Smyrna. Many Assyrians, who had survived in Hakkari and Mardin, made their way to the British Mandate of Iraq, which included Mosul, and with it Nineveh and other ancient Assyrian cities. On their journey, they were continually harassed by Kurdish irregulars who continued their own struggle for independence. Following the Russian Revolution, many Assyrians attempted to return to their homes in Hakkari province. They were led by Aga Petros, the man who had led the Christian resistance around Lake Urmia in Iran. Under Mustafa Kemal, the Turks had created a national republic and had effectively nullified the stipulations of the more harsh Sèvres by military fiat. The new Treaty of Lausanne established an enlarged territory with no prospect of an independent Kurdistan, let alone an independent Assyria. Agapetros's expedition met with failure. Kurds came to predominate in the depopulated Christian regions, and many of the Assyrian women left became Islamicized. Here I'm reading from an article written by Nawruz Atto, What Could Not Be Written, a study of the oral transmission of the cipher. In the post-genocide period, in its attempt to deny it, the Turkish state was successful in silencing any high culture and written text in relation to the genocide. Indeed, master narratives were circulated in Turkish society in order to spread its own propaganda among its citizens. It has been argued that the Kemalist dictatorship continued the Committee of Union and Progress policy of suppressing all information on the 1915 genocide, including preventing books about the genocide published outside Turkey from entering the country. The Union and Progress Party was the party of Talat Pasha. In the first decades of the Turkish Republic, Turkish ruling elites had already developed a policy to ban non-Turkish music in Diyarbakir, the eastern province of Turkey. Patriotic songs and poetry were among the most important activities which intellectuals and political leaders of different ethnic groups accommodated the romantic idea of national awakening in pre- and post-genocide period, and therefore these activities also became subject to restrictive policies. The top-down imposed silence was also required from the victim groups. Public silence among the Assyrians regarding the genocide arose in the aftermath of the 1922-1923 Lausanne Conference, where a new peace treaty between Turkey and the Allied forces was negotiated, resulting in the treaty. Although its minority clauses included specific rights for non-Muslim minorities, Assyrians were later excluded following an insertion of a clause in 1931 that narrowed the definition of non-Muslim minorities to Armenians, Greeks, and Jews only, and thus denying Assyrians any access to these rights already tentative. Struggling to obtain a political foothold in the aftermath of the First World War, Assyrians negotiated the position and rights. At the 1919 peace conference, the Assyrians presented several petitions. In one case, Patriarch Elias III had deputized his successor, the Archbishop Bazaram, to represent the Syriac Orthodox Church and petition the following: that our ancient Assyrian nation had suffered proportionately more than any other nation, regrets that Assyrians had been neglected by the European press and diplomatic correspondence, in which all the Turkish massacres are called the Armenian massacres, while by right they should have been called the Christian massacres, asked for the emancipation, the independence of the Vilayet of Diyarbakir, Bitlis, Kharput and Urfa from the Turkish yoke, protested against the establishment of Kurdish authority, asked for indemnities and compensation of the damages, and asked for assurances of our national and religious future. Archbishop Bazaram ended this petition with, "We count on the justice of the peace conference to listen to our nation with sighs for a tolerable future in which she can play her ancient role of a Syrio-Chaldean civilization." However, the requests of the Archbishop were ignored. Reflecting on the process of the negotiations at the Paris Peace Conference years later, he expressed his despair at the way Western powers had dealt with the plight of his people. "There I laid bare all the catastrophes which had befallen my people. I spared no detail in describing the suppression and the horror, even though I particularly emphasized how our casualties had been both massacred in cold blood and had perished from hunger and cold during the war, when I saw that not one of the conference participants shed a tear or felt any compassion for us. I felt as if I had delivered my speech to statues carved from stone." The above clearly shows that the international community had already abandoned the Assyrians soon after the First World War. In this state of despair, Assyrians living in Turkey had to carry on with their lives as survivors of a catastrophe. The church remained the only institution of Assyrians, yet even that was left with terrified and traumatized leaders in charge of managing the remaining flock. What is especially significant about the loyalty discourse of the church leadership is that it led to the silencing of everything that could be deemed dangerous to the survival of the remaining community, so as to avoid any confrontation with the new Turkish rulers. I argue that it was because of such fear of Turkish repercussions that the church leadership directed their community to focus on basic religious practices rather than ethno-national rights, including remaining silent in public about their genocide. For example, Patriarch Elias tried to convince the remaining community in Urfa, "We have to safeguard the lives of the living because the dead are not coming back to life." According to Shakir, the Patriarch's secretary, Patriarch Elias advised his community members not to develop close relations with Armenians and not to get involved in their movements, not even in their cultural activities, such as music, which were then perceived as a symbol of national awakening. "Keep our movements which trespass on Ottoman sensitivities, matters such as composing music. I see the Turkish state through the officials with whom I am in contact. They regard the Armenians with extreme caution, and that through a finely focused microscope." Being aware of the fact that the new Turkish rulers required loyalty from the Assyrians, their Syriac Orthodox Church leadership warned them not to be involved in anything that could be interpreted as disloyalty towards Turkey. Socio-politically, there was thus no incentive for writing or publishing eyewitness accounts. As mentioned, this was already being hindered by the Turkish authorities, and would be considered an act of disloyalty towards the Turkish state and nation. Ishak Amale, a Syriac Catholic priest, was one of the few exceptions. While living in Lebanon in 1919, he published his eyewitness account anonymously in Arabic under the pseudonym of the Eyewitness. In his book, the Maduto di Soroy, Abraham Gabriel Sawami, one of the Sypho orphans in the Assyrian orphanage in Adana in Turkey, mentions another case from the early 1920s pertaining to attempts made by the religious leadership of the Syriac Orthodox Church to keep its members quiet about the Sypho and the rights of their people in the post-Sypho Turkey. The monk Yohanan Dolabani was given orders by his religious superiors, i.e. the Patriarch Elias, to keep quiet and stop writing patriotic poems and songs. They were afraid of Muslim reprisals and revenge if the Assyrians continued to raise their voice for national rights in the Assyrian areas. This was confirmed by the later Archbishop Julius Y. Cicek. Yohanan Dolabani was a monk at the Zarafan Monastery in Mardin during the war years, and later Archbishop of Mardin, who personally witnessed the atrocities. Nevertheless, although he published more than 70 books in Syriac, Arabic, and Turkish, he did not write anything about the Sypho. He even remained silent in his own biography, a place where one would expect to find personal reflections about daily life. There may be manuscripts and notes that he did not write, that he did write, that have remained behind closed doors in Turkey, where the denialist state policy continues. In 2005, Archbishop Athanasius Aprem Barsoem of Beirut mentioned to me that he had written an article in the Lebanese newspaper about the Sypho, where he had been asked by Patriarch Zaka to stop publishing material on the Sypho, because the Turkish authorities requested this of him, through the Syrian government. After informing me of this, he looked sad, but seemed to have accepted the situation, considering the position he was in. Recently, his cousin stated that after the publication of the newspaper article, the Archbishop was no longer allowed to travel to Turkey. There are several other reasons for the eyewitness accounts about the Sypho in Turkey, with a few exceptions. The intellectual body of the Assyrians was wiped out during the genocide. With those who were killed, a culture and way of life disappeared. Certain invaluable knowledge about the people vanished, and memories were lost. Most of the educated elites, who were often the clergy, were killed, and the fact that the majority of Assyrians living in rural areas were illiterate made it even harder to obtain written eyewitness accounts. If any accounts were written down, inevitably some must have been destroyed or lost during and after the genocide. This high illiteracy among the victim group, however, contributed to the phenomenon of oral transmission of storytelling. One reason why literate survivors who could write chose not to write was because they did not prioritize writing about what they had witnessed, because their focus was on their daily survival in a state of crisis. In his introduction, for instance, Karabashi notes that his accounts may look unorganized because they are not written chronologically. He then explains this is because the accounts are from the same time as when the sword of tyrants were pulled from their sheaves and shed blood without mercy. This is how every village and town became in deep grief, and every house became a house of grief. As previously mentioned, another reason for the silence about the Sipho in and outside the Turkish public sphere is that in the first decades after the Sipho, the Assyrians did not have a strong organized diaspora like the Armenians that could raise their issue to a political agenda, an international political agenda. The tale, The Agony of the Christians in the Middle East, does not end here. In fact, it continues and worsens. But I do not feel that this format is sufficient to be able to explain the implications of the continued persecution of Christians in the recent decades until modern day. Instead, I would like to leave this to the format afforded by The History of Today, my series with Semiagog. We're finishing off this topic on the agony of Middle Eastern Christendom, a history of persecution. I want to refer back to a poem. This is a poem written by Galo Shabo, the leader who had forced back the Kurds and the Turks in the defense of Awado. The inhabitants of this village, together with the refugees from other villages, managed to successfully defend themselves against the Turkish soldiers and the Kurds, of course, as previously stated. After Galo Shabo fled to Iraq, he wrote a long poem, essentially serving as an eyewitness to what he had experienced during the war. In this poem, he laments what had happened to his people and why he thinks it happened. The explanations of Galo Shabo are multidimensional and assume both an innerworldly and a religious discourse. When he relates historical facts and his sources for such, like the political situation in relation to different groups who were involved in the war, he remains in the innerworldly discourse. But when he tells about the most difficult time of the battle during their defence in Awado, he enters a religious dimension. Because of our iniquity, the walls that surrounded us were breached. Our Lord's mercy, which protects us, he distanced from us. Believe, O my brothers, that our wrongdoing is greater than any other. For God forbid the Muslims to chastise us, except if it be rightly so. The alternative name for this series is The Agony of Middle Eastern Christendom. Agony here has a very specific connotation, that being Christ's agony in the Garden of Gethsemane, where he awaited his betrayal, his capture, his trial before the Sanhedrin, his condemnation before Pontius Pilate, and his crucifixion. During the crucifixion, Christ called out in Aramaic, in terms of its appropriateness to Assyrian culture and the Assyrian nation, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, that is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, in the account of Matthew. This to me confirms the diophysitism of the Council of Chalcedon, referencing back again to the religious schisms that divided forever the Christian community in the Middle East. This, to me, has an aspect of hope for the denizens, the Christians of the Middle East, the certain hope of resurrection in the face of persecution, that there may come deliverance and the distant hope of the resurrection of Christian fortunes in the Middle East, despite their ongoing persecution to this day. I wish to end this series by reading from Psalm 22, the prophecy regarding ultimately what Christ would pronounce during the crucifixion. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me? And from the words of my groaning, O my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not hear, and in the night season, and I am not silent, but you are holy, enthroned in the praises of Israel, our fathers trusted in you. They trusted and you delivered them. They cried to you and were delivered. They trusted in you and were not ashamed. But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised by the people. All those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, he trusted in the Lord. Let him rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. But you are he who took me out of the womb. You made me. Trust while on my mother's breasts. I was cast upon you from birth. From my mother's womb you have been my God. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan have encircled me. They gape at me with their mouths, like a raging and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue clings to my jaws. You have brought me to the dust of death. For dogs have surrounded me. The congregation of the wicked has enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look and stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. But you, O Lord, do not be far from me. O my strength, hasten to help me. Deliver me from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth and from the horns of the wild oxen. You have answered me. I will declare your name to my brethren. In the midst of the assembly I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, glorify him. And for him, all your offspring of Israel. For he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction or the afflicted. Nor has he hidden his face from him. But when he cried to him, he heard. A posterity shall serve him. It will be recounted of the Lord to the next generation. They will come and declare his righteousness to a people who will be born, that he has done this.